Hey there, Tape Traders. JD Sloan here with another episode of the Tape Traders Guide to 90s Pro Wrestling. On this episode, this is actually from a upcoming video project that I have for the Grizzled series. We have Francisco Chiazzo, and now the volume 2 of the Grizzled series, Kroll the Deathstalker. So me and Kevin went over to Kroll's place and sat down and chit-chatted with him for about an hour. This audio that I'm going to be playing for the podcast is joined in progress of the video. So when it comes on, it'll kind of come on in the middle of Kroll talking, and that's kind of what happens. So hopefully you'll enjoy this, and if you're interested in seeing the video, it'll be up on High Spots and WrestleTopia TV soon, and you can also email me or message me on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. WrestleTopia is your number one place for any of these things. So hopefully everyone enjoys this, and this is Volume 2 of the Grizzle series, Kroll the Deathstalker.
About 85... You know, it was, wrestling was pretty cool, but to me back then, because you had all the territories, but you had all of the cream of the crop. You know, you had nothing was really stale because everybody's, you know, was over. You could watch the AWA on ESPN. You could watch, like I said, 6-7 hours on Saturday, just local programming. But you know, I don't know. I loved it.
Around what age were you when you decided that, man, I'm gonna do this? Like,
well, when I was younger, I used to make cardboard belts. I mean, in great detail. I mean, put several hours of time in them, like you would a real belt. And Jeff Jarrett had a scoop through the Memphis territory, USWA, and I sent him a big, probably about twice as to. The actual size of the belt, but I sent him a version of the Unified World Title Belt with my application. I never heard nothing back, so I finally don't even remember how, but about a month later, I think I just showed up at their school, and it was basically you just buy a gym membership with fitness trainers at the time out in Gulletsville, and pay like $25, $30 a session, and it was like once a week on Sundays.
Where at?
In Gulletsville, off of Long Hollow Pike, that shopping center there, right off the interstate.
Yeah. Where like the Kmart and stuff is, or used to be?
It's on Conference Drive there. So
oh, yeah.
You come up away from it, that's
And who was the trainer?
Basically, the way the school worked, Memphis ran Louisville about once a month on Sundays, like a Sunday afternoon matinee kind of deal. And that's how I got into good friends with Tony Falk, because he would be the one that would show up to collect all the money and run the school. And Tony's a wealth of knowledge, but Tony's also shy and, you know, doesn't like confrontation and what. So basically I would, you know, run the drills and give the drills, and I got my money's worth. I got my time, you know. So that's how me and him hit it off. But the trainers were Jeff, and on the some weeks that Tony couldn't do it or was booked or in the angle or whatever, it was Dr. Tom Pritchard. So basically, the 9-10 months that I went there, it was Jeff Jarrett, Tony Falk, and Tom Pritchard, but mostly Tony.
Tony was pretty much the main trainer.
The time I went there.
And this is what, 91?
This is April 92, and I had my first match in March of 93.
So when you made the decision to go and get trained, and did you how much did you know walking in? I mean, by the early 90s, things were kind of, you know, I mean,
what, knowing if it was fake, it was a work?
Yeah. I mean, no. How much of that did you know?
The way they trained you, which looking back at it was pretty cool. You would go in there, you would run spots, drills, you know, tackle drop down, lock up, twist arm, you know, all that, but they never smartened you up, because, and my fourth match was in the Mid-South Coliseum, and that's the first time I ever heard the word kayfabe. So, you know, I mean, they never smartened
So it was all
they never pulled you aside and say, hey, you know, this is a wizard. All that, you know, like you pretty much knew it because Kane, Glenn Jacobs, they would make anybody that would come through the territory at that time that needed ring rust or whatever, they would have them come to the school. Like Glenn Jacobs, he was coming to the school when he was doing the Christmas Creature. And that was in late 92, yeah.
So it was just a lot of cardio drills. They worked you, the ring, showed you how.
The ring that they had was in a room about this size with about an 8.5-foot ceiling. The ring was, basically, it was a real good bumping ring, but there was no way to get tension on the ropes. The way we did drills, we would do them out of the corners because you couldn't shoot somebody off and hit the ropes. Because
you'd hit the wall.
Well, no, you wouldn't do that. The ropes. There's no way you get tension on the ring for the ropes to be tight, so the ropes sag like
so
that.
So you weren't bouncing?
No, you could out of the corners. You just had to, you know.
Right.
You know.
The tightest area.
Well, not so much tight because you learn the art of wrestling is you make it look intense.
Right.
Without the, you know, without killing somebody.
Right.
But you would run drills, you know. Basically, they would, you know, make you do about 15 minutes of cardio, you know, warming up and stuff and stretching. Then you get in there and, you know, they show you how to lock up, which when I was going to it, it was about 18 or 20 people. And it was, to be honest, it was just a cash grab for Jeff because the territory was on its ass. The business was on its ass then. And that was just a way for Jeff to have an extra income with the wrestling.
Right.
Because Jeff's a good dude. But his heart wasn't in it, you know. It was just right. It was just for the money.
Right. That's why Tony was, you know, was y'all's main trainer.
Because when we were, when I was in the school, it was a kid that moved down here from Virginia, a good friend of mine, Leon Downs. And the only reason they started using us out of the school was because another good friend of mine out of the school, Ebron Hatchett, who wrestled around here recently, is Norray Havoc. He's the one that went to Jeff and said, "Hey, these guys are ready." Because Ebron was training Jeff's younger brother Jason in amateur when he was still in high school. And the Jarretts loved Ebron Hatchett, especially Christine Jarrett. You know, he was, you know, they started using him, and him and Miss Texas was working around the territory against PG-13 and stuff. So, you know. But that's how we actually got started.
Working. So, in the, what was it, the 9 months that you trained before your first match?
Yeah.
Did you at any time were you like, oh shit, what did I decide to do?
Well, no, because no? I always wanted to do it. You know, most of the guys that get in the business have to have a cocky attitude. You know, you got to believe in what you're doing if anybody else is going to believe. You know, you got to have that arrogant kind of to a degree. I never was that guy. I was more of a creative guy. I always loved it and wanted to just do it. I was happy in there bumping, taking bumps. You know, after I started working, I got harassed by other people. Man, when you're 300 something pounds, you shouldn't be taking big backdrops and big splashes off the top. And, you know, that's just how the mentality of the business was back then. But no, when I started working, I was working just regular outlaw mud shows, as James E. Cornette would like to say. But, you know, just working other shows around here. Then Ebron got Jeff, you know, to actually look at us, and we started doing, they never used us on TV at first. They would book us in Memphis, then we'd do a Buddy Wayne show, and then, you know, when we'd go to Memphis. But I never did Louisville, but I did the rest of the loop. I did Evansville, I did Nashville, I did Memphis. My fourth match was in Memphis, Mid-South Coliseum against Jeff Gaylord, like the first, second match of the card. And his stupid ass fell off the top rope trying to come off to give me his finish, like a flying shoulder tackle, whatever it was. And Eddie Marlin, he pulled me to the side. He goes, "Can I give you some constructive criticism?" And I said, "Sure." And I said, "I don't really have a choice." He said, "Good answer." He goes, he said, "You walked out there in that big leather gimmick and all that." He said, "You look like a big scared pussy." And I said, "Well, I felt like one," because even the business was on its ass, they were still drawing probably 2,500 people in Memphis on Mondays.
Uh-huh.
You know, so here I am, 19-year-old kid, like, you know, and come out the curtain, they're like, "Motherfucker," you know, they were pretty hostile. And they would chew you up and eat you, spit you out if they knew, you know, which I was learning, you know.
Right.
And
another
funny thing, Eddie Marlin told me, he said, you know, because we're all, you know, kids and marks, but he goes, next time that dumbass Jeff Gaylord falls off the top rope, he says, take the count out, because I went to the outside to check on him and, you know, kind of threw him in, and he just did a shitty fucking roll up like a trip through the ropes coming in, rolled me up, pinned me, which was fine, but, you know, as a 19-year-old green, as a 19-year-old greenhorn in Memphis, Mid-South Coliseum, my fourth match, I was like, damn, I could have won. Because back then, I never really won matches, even on the little, you know, outlaw mud shows or, you know, shitty indie towns around, you know, nobody really pushed you. And, you know, I won a match here or there, but for the first year or two, I was as big as I was and as good as my gimmick looked, I was still just learning and putting everybody over.
Right.
Not that I cared, but it's, you know.
What was the talent crop like? You know, 93, 92, 93, well, things were really changing for the Memphis territory.
Well, I worked about 6 months with them, just doing one or two shots a week, sometimes three. And I mean, basically you were starved, because I was still working a full-time job, so I would have to take off a couple of days here and there. But the independent shows around Nashville, you could make more money working those like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday than you could working for them, you know. Plus you're not driving as far and as long, you know. So after about 6 months, you know, because I never wanted to be in the WWE. I know that sounds stupid, but I just wanted to do it. You know, just like how, you know, I got into the creative of the TV and doing posters and everything. It's just, you know, that creative itch, you know. I mean, I don't want to be somebody like Gary Elmore running around here for 30 years with my bandana on and my belly hanging out, thinking that I'm a, you know, a big freaking star. I mean, and I'm not trying to shit on Gary, but I mean, you know, how many times can you do something? And I mean, if he loves it, what he's doing, God bless him, more power to him, but, you know, I want to evolve and get better. You know, I was always more interested anyway behind the camera than I was in the ring. Big Bully Douglas asked me one time, he says, do you miss getting in the ring? I said, to be honest, no. I said, one, because I'm fat and married and out of shape. And I said, I don't want to be embarrassing to myself, let alone the business. But, you know, I had more fun just being on the booking creative end of it, especially doing a TV product like when we did Saul, you know. Mm-hmm.
When did you start evolving? When did you start learning?
I wasn't comfortable talking, cutting a promo to about 2 years in.
Uh-huh.
And the first person that ever really, I feel like, did anything to really appreciate trying to help me was on Tuesday nights. I think it was either Tuesday or Thursday nights. Ben Jordan has somebody, they were booking a place called Tennessee City around Dixon, Tennessee, and I would work to 8 o'clock at night working in a grocery store I grew up working in. And then my wife, my girlfriend at the time, we would fly down to Dixon on Tuesdays and I'd do his show. And that was the first place I ever really got pushed. And Tom Burton at the time, I was doing an angle with him, and for whatever reason, I was the baby face, even though my gimmick looked like a heel. And he didn't want to put me over. He didn't want to, you know, even in the ring, he didn't want to, you know. But Ben is probably one of the best dudes to ever, you know, be around, because he's not corrupt and full of shit and for himself. Like I'm saying, him and Steve Neely, they're the first ones that really, like, at the shows opened up and made you feel welcome, would give you advice as far as the local Middle Tennessee area. And Ben and them were pushing me as their champion. And I dropped it to Tom, and the angle of the blow off, they were putting it back on me. And you just tell he didn't want to do it. One, because I was green, and two, guys, like I said, you got to have all that. But I mean, you know, it's business. You know, it don't freaking matter if you get beat, you win or lose or whatever. It's not real. It's a fucking business. You know. But I mean, there's been people I didn't want to put over. I didn't want to work. But I thought, you know, my thing, if a guy looks like a wrestler and halfway talk, has any potential, and is trying to get better, you know, then you got, you know, Benny's trying, but if guys are just there taking up space and not doing anything, just spinning their wheels, I mean, yeah, you know, fuck them. But yeah, Ben Jordan and Steve Neely, they were the first two that actually would, you know, make you feel at home and stuff. But Eron was the first one that actually, you know, looked out for me, but he was as green as I was. He was just, you know, had a better spot than I had, you know.
Talk about some of the early promotions that you were working for in the 90s, because there was quite a few promoters in the
working
area.
Working around here, you could work at least, if you were working around here and you really wanted to be a wrestler, you could work Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday within an hour or 2 hour radius. Like the loop that I pretty much worked the whole time I was here, you had Shelbyville every Thursday for almost 20 years or more. Then on Friday, you usually had somebody running Nashville. At the time I started, it was Terry Rice. And then on Saturday, you had Columbia, Lewisburg. You had probably seven or eight towns running around Middle Tennessee, not even Nashville, but just within 45 minutes to an hour of Nashville running. So if you couldn't get booked on Saturday, you know, might as well just, you know, go to the movies or something. But then on Sunday, Tony Falk and his brother, they were running Paducah, Kentucky every other Sunday, like the first and third Sunday. But that's where my relationship with Tony really got cemented. And me and him, you know, for the longest time, Tony still is my brother, but, you know, we've been just disconnected because, you know, we're not really doing anything. But that's where I really cut my teeth and really actually doing posters. And I don't mean using Photoshop, I mean actually using a typewriter and a copy machine, blowing stuff up, cutting paste at Kinko's at 2 in the morning. And
do you have any of those posters still?
If I do, I'm sure Tony does.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to have some, but that's how I pretty much cut my teeth in doing that. But Tony ran Paducah for like 9 years, and I was up there probably for at least 7 of it.
So is that when you first started doing more hands-on things, back behind the curtain type of stuff?
No, not really. Not at that time, because, I mean, far as just putting posters together and doing something other than just being a talent.
Yeah.
But when TJ, God, I love TJ and miss you, brother. But TJ, my two biggest brothers in wrestling would have to be Tony Falk, Mike Searcy, TJ Weatherby, and James Carver, as far as people that I would talk to on a daily basis outside of wrestling or whatever. It's just, you know, and all four of those guys have been there and done stuff for me, and I've done stuff for them. And, you know, God bless TJ, man. God, damn, I miss it. But, you know, you talking about some good times, even if we wasn't wrestling, I talked to him at least sometimes 2-3 times a day. But TJ had started running, TJ had gotten a business because he worked for Wayne Hackney, and Wayne Hackney had started sponsoring Burt, and then Farron pulled him away from Burt, and they started running New South in 97.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember New South.
And then after that folded, after about 6 months of that, TJ started running New South in Madison Square with Jeff Hargis' gym out there.
Yeah.
And then
the Excalibur gym?
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I knew TJ. So by that time, Randy Hells was doing Memphis Power Pro, and Tony would go down there. Tony was the booker for TJ. Tony and Farron were always the bookers of the Excalibur shows. And Farron had wound up quitting and going to work for Burt. And it was Tony booking the shows, where Tony would go and do a Friday night spot show for Randy Hells and then do Memphis Power Pro TV. He was like doing the headsets and stuff. So he was making more than just a regular payoff. So that he would take off and have me so that's how I got involved with booking. And I hadn't been in the business probably 7 years at the time. But that's when I started transitioning.
Doing more things behind the scenes. And
yeah.
And did you find that to be, did you know instantly, did you know, this seems more fulfilling than maybe being in the ring?
Yeah, because I've always been a creative person, because, you know, for like, before they ever made replica belts, I love Jim Cornette's promos and shoot interviews and stuff and his podcast, but as he would say, all the Outlaw Mud shows and the indies, or whatever you want to call them, outlaw, you know, but before replica belts come out, I probably made 9 out of 10 belts around here. And actually some of my belts I made are still floating around here.
Uh-huh.
But I got into doing that, and So I always just been a real creative person as far as, you know, trying to figure out something and figure out how it works and do it and, you know, duplicate stuff you like, you know, taking something from something and, you know, just like wrestling, you know, like, you know, I've been doing this since 92. So, you know, now like Kevin, you know, that's why I try to mentor Kevin, you know, you at times, you know, just, you know, you take something. That's what's wrong with wrestling in general around here is, you find something, leave it better than you found it for the next crew or the next, you know.
Right.
You know, because you don't know how many places and schools and TV stations you talk to. You go and try to put your product on or put on something and it's like, oh, we've been burned by this person or that person. You know, so it just makes it harder to operate.
And, right.
You know, just like now, how many times have you, how many years has it been since we had a weekly show in Nashville since Tony shut down?
Right, yeah. You know. Yeah, I mean, that's very true. There's a lot of spot shows.
Yeah.
They come in and they run a show and then they're gone or they...
Yeah, but how many of them are actually, if, you know, bare bones? How many of them are profitable?
Oh.
Just like Crimson. Yeah. Just like Crimson.
Yeah.
You know, what they're doing in Clark's was amazing.
Yeah, it is.
But if the money is really there, I would be doing it more.
Right.
You know, and for him, it might just be that, you know, he don't want to, you know... oversaturated or whatever, but I mean, look how good a school's does. You know, at least it appears from the outside looking in. You know, they got some good shit going on, and they pack out that place they're at. But you know, I mean, what does he do? Maybe three a year.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and then a couple bar shows.
Why not do about 6 a year?
Right, right. Yeah. You know? I mean,
that's true. But one of the reasons he probably doesn't because it's a lot of fucking work. but my hat's off to you, Tommy. I mean, you got some good shit going up there, and that was a town. Back in the early 90s that nobody ever ran
because it never drew. Murfreesboro, right? Like, it's always knew that everyone ever went there never drew any money. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's definitely, I mean, and his shows are, I think another reason why he only does three or 4 years, his shows are huge. They're big money, cost-wise, budget-wise, you know, big shows.
Yeah, but the bottom line, regardless if it's 100 people, or 5 million fucking people, if you're not putting a little extra cheddar in your pocket, you know, who's the fucking mark?
Right.
Not calling anybody a mark by name or trying to single nobody out, but you know, I've been doing this stuff since 92, and I guarantee you I've lost a lot more money than I ever fucking made.
Right.
But, you know, you do it because you love it, but you also do it to try to, you know.
Try to make a little something.
Like a habit that always paid for itself, you know, which, you know. But, you know, now today it's a whole different ball game than what it was when I first started.
So, kind of talk about when USWA went out of business in 97, that was kind of the cusp of the big wrestling bubble that kind of took place nationally. Well, and things really kind of, you know, Burt Prentice came in and started running the fairgrounds, Music City.
Nothing really changed for Nashville because Burt kind of took over.
Just kind of swooped in Saturday night, still stayed the same.
And, I mean, he's, you know, Burt's a cockroach. I mean, he'll be here with the cockroaches.
Right. I mean, no, you're right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I've never had a relationship with Burt, and I'm not trying to bury Burt, but Burt.
I don't think that's burying him.
Burt is the last of a dying, you know, you call it putting him over, whatever. When, you know, but it was a lot different before Burt and other promoters around here started running because the difference that you say it is about that is that, like, all the towns that you could work, nobody really worked together, but nobody really was, like, trying
to... There was a new person in every single town.
You would have somebody every now and then pop up and run opposition in somebody's town or something, and it wouldn't last.
Right.
But when Burt got here and Mike Porter got here, it turned into that thing where if you work my show, you can't work his show. You
know? Right, yeah.
And I mean, for what? You know, those back then, guys, if you were making 50, 60 bucks, you were on top. You know? And guys like me did good to probably make 20, 30 bucks.
Right.
And, you know, it just, I just never understood that. I mean, you know, I understand that, you know, it's different if they're booking them, you know, like three or four times too. And another good analogy of how the business has changed from the time I started to now, a lot of the guys that Burt uses now, he wouldn't even gave the time of day, even 10, 15 years ago. But I mean, as far as a promoter, Burt Prentice has stood the test of time around here. You know, say what you want to about him. Urban legend, you hear more bad stuff than you do good, but I'm sure people have buried me and said shit about me. But you know, he'll be around until he's, you know. But But yeah, I mean, when in 97 when Memphis shut down, it didn't really change because Bert, you know,
swooped right at 2 weeks.
It might have been a few months or right. 4 weeks or whatever, but I mean they were on mm-hmm. on the local
TV channel, same as USWA.
You know, but
so let's talk about the fairgrounds now. You always being a Nashvilleian, mm-hmm. and when did you first start going and seeing events at the Nashville Fairgrounds?
Well, the family I grew up in, my dad, he was always more of a partier. He worked hard. He was a self-employed drywall finisher, you know. So he would work hard, but he'd party harder. So the time he got off on Friday, it was, you know, not that he was, you know, he provided everything we needed.
Right, right.
But, you know, he didn't care about wrestling. He, you know, but he never would, you know, it was like, when I was a kid, if I wanted wrestle magazines or action figures or something, I was out cutting grass.
Right.
That's how I, you know, he wouldn't give me money for that. But like my brother-in-law at the time, to my oldest sister, he took pity on me. And the first actual show I ever went to was in 86 because nobody in my family, none of my friends would go. So he actually took me out there. And he was about half drunk when he took me. And it was after the show. We got there. And it's like the semi-main in the ring. I think it was Dutch and Buddy Landell. And then the main event was Lawler and Uncle Elmer against the Mod Squad. And I got to see that. And, you know, of course, you see them missing them by 6 inches. But I was just, you know, fascinated by it. And, like, I got separated from my brother-in-law and sister. And they were out back behind the fairgrounds. And you see Buddy Landell. And it just, you know, it was like... cool, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, I always wanted to do it just because I loved it, and just, you know, just something, you know, just. But from the time I can remember, probably 5-6 years old, I was always watching it. But that was my first ever match, and that was probably sometime during the summer of '86.
Wow. So, who were some of your favorites to see at the Nashville Fairgrounds? You know, did you see Billy Joe Travis wrestling?
Billy Joe Travis, man, God bless his soul. He was, if Billy wasn't messed up, he was the nicest dude that you could ever, you know, as far as advice. I mean, first time I met Billy was through the school. They would come out there and work out. Randy Savage, I met him out there working out. You know, a lot of those guys would come through, you know. Uh-huh. Especially if they were doing Louisville, they would stop through there on their way going to Louisville. Uh-huh. But Billy was a good dude. I worked with Billy a lot with Tony and TJ and a lot of Mike Porter shows with him in Columbia.
I think he's kind of an unsung hero, but I don't think enough people really know him. You know, he was always, when I moved here, he was one of the guys that Bert pushed a lot. He was always on Bert's TV.
Yeah.
And I think when I was a kid, I was like, I couldn't get it. I was like, what the hell is, what is this guy with his one leg, you know, tights with the one leg.
The first time I seen Billy Travis on TV, him and Tracy Smothers were on, they wasn't like, I would say job guys, but they were like middle card baby faces. They would do a lot of jobs on TV, but they were teaming a lot then. That was probably around 83, 84 maybe. But yeah, Billy was a good dude, man.
So, you've had the opportunity to be a big part of multiple fairgrounds shows, especially later on.
Yeah.
Kind of talk about what it's like to promote the fairgrounds, to run the fairgrounds, to have a show, your very first show that you were more than just a performer.
Yeah. Well, I always wanted Tony to evolve as a promoter and a promotion. And like I said, he was shy and timid. Like when we had about a 2 year and 2 month run in Madison at that building, he found that building and then come to my house, like, Crawl found a building. We pulled up, he's like, let's go. he still that way to this day. But I pushed him, make him go in there, and we had a 2 year and 2 month run. But whenever we were doing, we had about a 7 or 8 year run doing a USWO late night on Comcast, on a little shitty 49, channel 74, whatever it was. And, you know, I mean, the best thing I learned from Tony is making chicken salad out of chicken shit.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I thought for what we had for a good part of that, I got pretty good at that. But, I mean, you look at how good our promotion grew from the time from about 2001 to 2002 when he was running Springfield once a month, then went to twice a month. Then we got the building in Madison. We ran that every Friday for 26 months. And, you know, that was the same time when TNA first started. So, you know, all the talent that was coming in that was wanting to get signed by TNA, they were in town and they were just wanting to work. So we had a lot of those guys working for us, especially the girls.
ODB.
ODB, Tracy Brooks.
Athena.
Valentina.
You know, Lollipop.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Kizarni.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah.
Eric Young.
Yeah, Kid Cash, everyone lived here. So everyone could work the Wednesday nights and yeah.
Angelina Love.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Probably some more missing, but you know, that's where I thought I really hit my stride forward as trying to help him or book or whatever. But I always wanted that to evolve, and he had about a 7.5 year run at Stadium Inn, and the reason we shut down in Madison is because the guy filed bankruptcy on his business and didn't tell us. And just basically we showed up 1 week and the building, the lights was out and everything. That's how that ended.
Yeah, LT told me about that. You guys are still paying rent and
yep.
and the whole thing.
But that's how that ended. And then that was in December of 04. By May of 05, Bert had been running the Stadium Inn. And Builder Shields was always trying to get us to come down there. And like I said, I don't like stepping on people's toes or piggybacking off of other shows or buildings or whatever, unless I'm just really, you know, unless I know the people real sincere like I am.
Right.
I don't, you know.
Right.
But what Bill was doing is trying to play one against the other with Bert, you know.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of like Bert was the old thing with him, and, you know, because he wasn't smart. He was a
boy. Yeah.
But, you know. But Tony took a lot of shit from that motherfucker for 7 years now.
Bill?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's why Tony ran Friday and Saturday nights. Because if he didn't, somebody else would be in there running.
Right. Right.
You know.
And then Bill even started his own show, right? On Sundays?
Well, they tried on Wednesdays. They tried on, you know. But, I mean, Tony could have probably did a lot better if it was just him, you know.
One day a week.
Yep. But anyway, I always wanted Tony to evolve. And this whole time we're on Comcast 74 or 49, whatever it is. And, I had a little bit of money built up, and I wanted to run the fairgrounds just one time, just to say I did it. So we ran Christmas of 06 on a Monday night. And this is where me and Tony kind of split off, you know, where it kind of burned me. Basically, I funded the whole show. I did all the work, all the postering, all the advertising, got all the sponsors, you know, and basically Tony, you know, with Tony running there, we had to involve Bill, so it was basically a USWO, and we used his guys. We had way too many guys on the show, but it was a hell of a show. So we went in there. We had 326 paid, probably 150 comps with all the wrestlers, you know, because it was Christmas.
Friends,
you know,
family. Yeah.
Like Reno probably had 20 people in there, with family, friends and family. But anyway, we had Jerry Lynn. We had AM Vision, Eric Andrews, Chase Stevens, Chris Michaels. That was our main event angle, you know, but always enjoyed that, you know. But that show there actually profited almost $1,000, and I split that three ways with Bill and Tony, you know. But like I said about me and Tony, kind of, you know, I felt kind of burned by Tony is because, you know, we started this about 4 months before then.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know, I felt like they just laid down on me, and it was just me doing all the work. Like at the building, the fairgrounds, you know, I got out there at about 11 o'clock at morning to meet what's his name? The guy out of Georgia that's dead now, that used to rent rings. He trained Arn Anderson.
Ox?
No, he did the Nightmare gimmick.
Oh, Ted Allen?
Ted Allen, uh-huh. Yeah. Good, another good dude. We rented his ring and met him and his buddy out there, and this is Christmas Day, so the people running the concession didn't show up after our doors opened for about an hour. That pissed me off. Had everything there ready to go, and Tony comes walking in about 30 minutes before we opened the doors.
Mm-hmm.
And that really pissed me off. And the only excuse he gave me, my mama's in town. I'm like, well, you knew your mama's going to be in town. She knows you're a wrestling promoter. I mean, you know, come on, man. So I had TV going. I was doing everything. And that's the biggest thing about doing something and expanding and getting a little bigger. And, you know, after 6 months of that, or even a year, you're toast. You are absolutely toast. So after that, I stepped back and took a break after the first year with Tony. And at that time in Reno, we'd always had a good relationship and always wanted to do a good TV. Well, after about a year or two of talking about that, that's how Saul come about. Mm-hmm. Because in 07, between 06 and 07, there, TJ got a building in Millersville. And TJ, you know, I could walk into TJ and he'd be like, basically, you had an open book, you could do what you wanted. And it just kind of fell together that way. You know, me and Reno, we wanted to do TV so bad, we actually went to the Channel 19 thing through the local cable, and we took their classes and everything. And
the cable access?
Yeah, because they got a little nice studio out there, but you can never do nothing out there. But, you know, so finally after about 2 years of wanting to develop something in Reno, you know, TJ popped up. So that was how I kind of exited from Tony, and he's always kind of had a, you know, I know he thinks, Tony's attitude is everybody does something to hurt him. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, you know, that enriched about, you know, it's all about him kind of attitude. But, you know, like I told him, you know, it's not that. It's just, hey, you know, I'm doing everything here, at least over here. I got somebody that's going to carry the weight with me. So that's how, you know, Saul Wrestling started. We started doing TV in June of 07.
And it was Southern All-Star Wrestling, yeah, correct?
Which it should have been all the time. The reason that changed the show time is because Jerry Jarrett became involved for about 6 months with us, trying to get our show syndicated overseas and getting revenue coming in for that. And, you know, they didn't want it to sound regional, so it went to Showtime All-Star. Paul Adams is the one that actually coined that name, Showtime All-Star Wrestling.
So in the beginning, though, it was TJ's building. Was he already running shows?
TJ started running in February of 07.
Okay.
That's about the time I quit Tony. Tony, in his mind, for a long time, thought that this was all strategically planned, but it just kind of fell.
Happened at the same time.
It always kind of fell in my lap.
Right, So TJ's already running.
Yeah, TJ was already running. About May is when we all kind of come together and agreed to start doing something. I think the first taping we did was in May because the building was actually white. And if you walked in that building when TJ showed it to me, you would think, man, this is a, you know, it had a big,
It was a literal sawmill, correct? It was attached to a...
No, they just, Michael St. John called it that because it was so hot in there and the way it looked. They just come up that sawmill, you know, because the sawmill...
Saw wrestling and...
Yeah, that was Michael St. John that come. No, it used to be a auction house, and it's been, ain't no telling what all it's been, but it had duct work, like, that would about knock your head down going down the center of it. But Reno, I'd love to have what Reno spent on that building. But we went in there with a lot of his main event stuff he had for main event, the lighting he had from that. Mm-hmm. And we actually, you know, we didn't know anything about lighting, just like I didn't about video editing when I started doing
it. Started doing it.
You know, just got better as you went. You know, just like when you wrestle, you know, you're training to get better.
Yeah.
But so we
started. You guys painted it. Is that right? Yeah,
we TJ had just, his brother-in-law, or not his brother-in-law, but his brother Victor, had just painted it white, you know. And so this was in February, so here it is May, and we're in there painting it black. But the first time Reno, we just painted the walls black, you know. If you go back and look at some of those first episodes, you know, there's still some of it. But we did TV in there from May to February of 08, and that's when Jerry Jarrett came on board and was like, you know, Reno, if you really deck this building out, you know. So in like 6 days, Reno had his, at that time, Reno had a lot of rental property and had like little handymen that he had them in there, and they brought like two flatbeds of wood from Lowe's, and they built those risers, built that nice stage and ramp and everything. So Reno probably spent 15, 20 grand. I mean, just guessing. I mean,
right.
But bought a whole bunch of new lights. Had every one of them lights, I could hit a button, they'd all flash on and off. I mean, it was pretty high tech for 2008. But the whole time, Jerry Jarrett was trying to get us to where our product looked good enough to where they could sell it. Because, you know, talent never was a problem. I always had good talent, I thought, for what the area
was. Sure.
But You know, so that was the whole reason Reno was running the fairground, because they wanted a bigger building. So it come from looking like a little building, they wanted to look like a bigger building. So
when you guys kind of take over the building that TJ's already running, what was it called? Was it called Southern All-Star Wrestling when TJ was running it?
TJ came up with Southern All-Star Wrestling when he was running Excalibur Gym in like 98, 99. Uh-huh. I think he ran out there from like 98 to almost to late 99. I'm not sure. But he was out there for a little over a year, maybe a year and a half. But,
then you guys get together.
Originally, TJ was New South Championship Wrestling, and him and Farron had a falling out of, and Farron, you know, wanted to take the name, or they, you know, so that's that's how he came up with Southern All-Star Wrestling.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, TJ didn't run until he got that building in 07. So that was 99, this is 07. So, you know, he called it.
Uh-huh.
You know, Saul, and I always did his logos just like for Tony and everybody else. And
then you guys decided, hey, let's run a local television product.
TJ's, the deal with TJ is he wanted me up there running it.
Uh-huh.
Because TJ was just...
I have a building.
When I see James Carver, I see TJ Weatherly. Uh-huh. Because that was... TJ always had his crew of family and friends with him.
Right, right.
And that was their entertainment.
Right.
You know? Instead of going to the movies or going out and eating and stuff, that was like their bar hangout or whatever.
Right.
You know, so when I see James, that's one reason I think I love him so much, because he reminds me of TJ.
Right.
And
right.
That ain't a bad thing.
TJ, sure.
You know, as far as this shitty business, TJ Weatherby is a fucking saint. And I'm sure he's had his demons and problems with people and stuff, but to me, he's a fucking saint and always will be.
Right.
But that was the trade-off with TJ, that I would come in and run the show. And you always had that backlash from guys that wasn't being used on TV, mm-hmm. that were, like I said, just taking up space. Mm-hmm. Well, we're friends, you know. Like, I always try to smart TJ up. You know, if they're not producing, they're hindering you, because that makes you the mark, because they're just fucking showing up for your
money. Yeah. And so you guys, Reno comes on board, and you guys start producing a local television show.
Yeah. We were on.
When did Jerry? Because I remember the local show. I remember watching it.
Jarrett was involved with Saul for about 2 years. At first, it was just kind of a consultant to Reno, wanting to get it on somewhere. You know, he was impressed with the 6-day turnaround on what we did in that building, and came to that show. And then you probably didn't see or hear about him for another year. You know?
Okay.
Just, you know,
yeah,
we did this.
Feeding stuff to Reno.
And that was the whole reason. It wasn't ever really a separation from TJ and Reno or me. It was just that, you know, Reno had Grumpy's at the time. Jerry Jarrett was the one that went and got Grumpy's with Reno.
Okay.
You know, by getting Grumpy's as a sponsor, they were able to run the TV show. No, it paid. The TV was free. It was a barter deal
for
the station. So the TV didn't cost nothing. Jerry Jarrett was trying to get the TV to look a certain way. That way, a guy named Matthew Odie, that was one time syndicating for TNA, could shop it overseas.
Okay.
Because we did 6 months worth of TV, and I had to transcribe every episode verbatim of everything said on the show to put with the show.
For the closed caption?
To have it timed out to where he could go and sell 6 months worth of TV, 26 episodes, and have, you know, where they pay a guy to read it in English and overdub it and speak in another language.
In Spanish or Portuguese.
Because I don't know whose YouTube channel it's on, but one of the matches from the fairgrounds with Chase Stevens and David Young, it's in a different language. I don't even know what language it is. It's not Spanish or it's not... You know, it's but there was like 7 countries. Paul Adams would know more about this arena that we actually aired those 26 episodes aired in 6 or 7 different foreign countries. And there never was enough money to pay for all the transcribing, because I had friends of mine doing it. Him and his wife, they would transcribe all of them, and I had to print them out. And, you know, so like, here it is, you know, we were making like, you know, different copies. It's different shooting and stuff, so there it is, another, you know, I'm mass producing stuff, and so that was a different, but when Men Reno hooked up and did Saul, within 7 years of there, or my game anyway, got elevated from, but that was a lot of fun. But the fairground shows, the 7 or 8 fairground shows that Reno ran out there, were trying to get a pilot that Jerry could actually sell to the the India thing that TNA did, the Ring of King.
Yeah.
Jerry Jarrett was trying to get that too in that couple of year period there that I guess he wasn't with them.
Right.
And
Jeff was able to get it instead.
Well, no, I think they just got it by default because Jerry never could get the show like to his liking as far as the lighting and stuff. Because Reno spent a lot of money on those fairground shows.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and they would rent, have all these little specialty lights and stuff, but nobody would know how to run them. You know, and Paul's deals, oh, I'll do it. You know, but, you know, Paul spread himself too thin, too. But for about a 2 year period there, men Paul and Reno were clicking. I mean, it was good stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think there's been anything here locally since then that can probably ever will top it as far as the consistency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because to me, it's always about learning and getting better.
And then there was a series of bad events that took place. I don't know if you were still part of the everything that was going on, but there was, at one point, all the footage that Reno had shot for a TV taping was stolen out of a van.
Yeah, that's when I was got tired of dealing with Paul.
With Paul.
You know, with Paul's demons or whatever. I'm not trying to bury him, but just to be point blank and honest, I would work... I've worked at Budweiser, local distributor down here for the past 20 years, and that's my bread and butter. And, you know, I'm up at 4 in the morning at work, so I'm getting up at 3:30, 4 o'clock I'm at work. And Paul would always be a party or whatever, doing, you know, drinking or whatever his vices
were. Whatever he's doing.
You know, and I don't fault him for that because I grew up with a dad that liked to drink. But, you know, Paul and... You know yourself, Justin. Hey, Justin, we're doing these vignettes Wednesday at 4 o'clock over here at Fletcher's. Well, you show up at 4 o'clock on Wednesday, and hey, Paul, you don't hear from him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there, you know, Paul's bringing me like a Santel promo or an 18 promo or a vignette he shot with Kid Cash or whoever, or Chase or whatever, and it winds up being 11 o'clock at night, so there I am having to stay up all night Thursday to get the show ready for Friday. That way it could be delivered to the station within a day's time. And I'm, you know, that shit went on for over a year, so I just told Reno finally, I said, dude, I said, man, this ain't fun. It's, you know, I said, dude, you're scared, you know, you're scared to tell him or scared to, you know, whatever, you know, I don't care what he does, but, you know, it's affecting me.
Right.
You know, and it's not like we're getting rich doing this bullshit.
Right.
You know, yeah, after about a year, you know, I when they started doing the fairground shows, when I came back for whatever it was, 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months there, I wasn't there. And then I come back, and then I left again and came back because it never changed.
Now, at this time, did you, were back at the, everything shifted. Everything shifted back to the stadium then. Right. The reason
they never were in Millersville is because I was the connection to Millersville.
Right. Right. And the fairground shows, they were running Buffalo Billiards.
Well, the reason they ran all these other places is because I wasn't doing wrestling.
Uh-huh.
TJ was still running, and TJ never liked Paul Adams.
Uh-huh.
Never could get along with him. You know,
there was no heat with Reno.
I was the connection between, I was the glue
TJ,
or the connection,
Reno.
That building and TJ and Saul. I was the you know, whatever you want to call it, the connection, the friend, or the one that held it all, you know.
Right, yeah.
So when I wasn't with Saul, that's why they were running other places.
Mm-hmm. And then did you go back to Tony? Because didn't Reno and Paul they start running on Saturdays and Tony was running, it was still Tony on Saturday and Friday.
When TJ first started running Millersville, he ran on Saturdays.
Uh-huh.
But after about 4 months of that, it got hard for him to get good talent. And, you know, running weekly now is almost impossible.
Right, right.
To be financially stable.
Yeah.
So, after about 4 months of that, he wasn't drawing good. You know, it just got, you know, saturated and old.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I told him, you know, when Reno and me came up there, we were doing free TV tapings on Sunday for the first 2 months.
And then to after get people that, in the door.
And then after that, it got sour.
Right.
So, you know, we basically merged the two together. We did a few months on Saturdays, and it got better, but it got hard for us to get real good talent for the TV that we wanted. So that was the whole reason we went to Fridays, and he always did better on Fridays. Another thing, Tony always thought that was a stab at him, which it wasn't.
Right.
You know, it was just business.
Right, right.
And, you know, Tony thrived and still survived, you know, kind of that, you know. The only bad thing about that guy is, like, Gary Elmore would get mad, get his feathers ruffled with one and go work the other promoter. Yeah, he said this, blah, 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 you know, and I always try to tell
there's
Tony.
There's no making Gary happy, you know, though.
But, yeah, in between that time, two or three times, I went back to Tony trying to do something, mm-hmm. and it just never clicked for whatever, you know, because that magic was gone there. And, that, you know, he always, in the back of his mind, thought, you know, that I would, you know, the honeymoon was over.
Right.
You know, it was, you know, I had a good run with Tony, and it just, you know.
It was just finished.
You know, but I was still at the whole time, whether I was working there with him or not, he would always call me, and I would always consult him and give him advice on this guy or that guy, or, you know, or how Bill, you know. Mm-hmm. Tony about went the same dealing with Bill. Bill would, you know, do shit on purpose to fuck with him.
Right, right. You know. Yeah. But, so, and then let's kind of talk about Paul Adams leaves the, he is, everything kind of falls apart. And
well, what had happened is after the first couple of years, Reno had got to where he wanted, that's where Paul pretty much come into play. Paul took everything over, pretty much running it. And all I ever did for the, all I ever did was saw really was the TV. I never really booked any, I'd give an idea just, you know, like group friends would, mm-hmm. but it was, after about the first 3 years, it was all Paul. Mm-hmm. And Reno just wanted to show up and play wrestling or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
He didn't want to deal with all, you know, because like I said, it gets old.
He's got a real life, you know, he's got kids.
Yes.
Yeah. He's got a job, he's got a real life.
You know, so that's when it kind of, you know, like I said, for about 2 years we clicked like well-oiled machines.
Uh-huh.
And got some real good stuff out of it. But after that, it just kind of went, to, you know, I had left, and after a few months of me not being in Millersville, they got, to, you know, they just, it just wasn't clicking. So they had, there never was really no heat, like, hey, we're leaving, fuck you, TJ, or whatever. It was just like, they left, you know, uh-huh. because they did, you know, when there was no real confrontation on it or whatever. But from that time to the time I went back to Millersville full time with just me and TJ, what was that, probably 2011 to mm-hmm. 20,
yeah, it was 2011 into 2012.
About a year and a half, I was just, you know, spotted here. I helped, if I wasn't helping Tony, I was helping, about that time I started helping Mike Searcy a lot.
Uh-huh.
You know.
With Top Rope?
Yeah, and trying to do stuff with him.
And that is Lebanon?
Yeah, yeah. You know, so I bounced around from all those. And then in September, to the time TJ died, from September of, it was August of 2012. I pretty, you know, we'd always go eat on Saturdays at Fuji's.
Uh-huh.
And I'd always, you know, cut up with him. I'm like, man, you don't want me, you know, just, he knew I was fucking with him, but he goes, bullshit. And I knew that he'd been struggling, and fucking Marcus Pastores was up there trying to,
yeah, we'll talk about that.
You know, but, yeah. you know, but anyway, he had went through everybody trying to help him. And the thing about TJ, I could have walked in there anytime I wanted and had it back. You know, uh-huh. and do it my way, the way I want. Because if you're a promoter, the best advice I can give you from my experience, if you got a booker, regardless if they're a wrestler, somebody that refereed or whatever, regardless of what their history is, you got to give them the fucking room to succeed or fail. You can't just, you know, you can't backdoor book that shit.
Uh-huh.
You know, if, just like in a business, if you got, Justin, if you're managing my Walgreens, if I'm riding your ass and second guessing everything you're doing, that's not doing either one of
them. No, nothing's getting done.
You know, you got to give them the room creatively and everything to do what they need to do, whether they succeed or fail. And that was what, that's what blended with me and TJ so good. But when I went back up there in 2012, I went back up there and, you know, that's when Paul was doing, it was pretty much just Paul by
right.
himself.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were hit or miss on everything, pretty right. much. So that couple year period, Saul was pretty much just a shell of what it was, as far as from an operating standpoint. But in August of 2012, you know, I finally got over my moans and groans with the business and just, you know, being burned out, and was kind of refreshed and ready to really go in there and just goddamn take it by the horns and try to do what we did with it. But at the time, TJ was drawing whatever he was, you know, whether it was 5 people or 50 people, he was still going to run.
Uh-huh.
And it got so bad that he wouldn't run some weeks up there. You know, they canceled the show, it was so bad on some. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was my friend. He's done stuff for me. So, you know, I kind of felt, you know,
obligated to help. Yeah.
But I went up there in August of 2012, and, you know, we were, by November, we were fucking drawing 100 people again. You know?
Yeah.
And that's when Tony was still running.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And Tony was drawing pretty decent at that same time.
It wasn't long after that Tony was out of there, too.
Yeah.
And guess who got Tony up there running those Saturdays and Sundays up there?
At the sawmill, yeah.
That was me.
Yeah. And so at this time, so let's talk about your opinions on Crossfire Entertainment and Marcus Pastorius. And because he was working with Reno. He was a referee.
No, I hired him as a cameraman first.
Okay.
Because
he was the cameraman at the Gallatin show.
Yeah.
Yes, I remember. He had
me and Paul, when we were actually doing 3-4 cameras and had real good equipment and stuff, we would, you know, trying to depend on people to do it, we would try to recruit, you know, somebody. And I think he answered a Craigslist ad or something. Mm-hmm. That's how he come about. And he had the camera work for us, and he just kind of got, you know, well, we need a referee. Mm-hmm. He just kind of got thrown in there as a referee. And then about that time is when I quit doing much of anything except just sporadically here and there.
Right. Now, at the time, did he tell you guys that he was a TNA promoter? And
I think that, which on that was just what you hear amongst the boys, is he was like an intern.
Because Jason James has told, we like,
you know, Jason
the lowdown about the whole
basically
thing.
Basically, he was like an intern or something.
Right,
you
right.
Know, so.
But when I met Marcus, he had told me that he was a promoter for TNA, that he was running shows all over Philadelphia, just a lot of things. And so I didn't know what he had maybe told you guys at the time.
He never told me much anything, other than being a cameraman on a few shows. And then a referee.
Uh-huh.
You know, by that time, when I left pretty much helping other than Cersei or Tony for about that year on and off, he had gotten the spot of helping TJ.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And I don't think he ever had TJ's best interest at heart. You know, he was just kind of, you know, because that first cross, but I never was around the Crossfire shit.
I
do know the first fucking show they ran, he ran it as Saul.
Yes, it was a...
And then Reno served him with a cease and desist because Reno showed him who owned the trademark.
So, which is why he's...
And here's why I don't like that motherfucker, because of shit like this.
Yeah.
He had TJ so fucking paranoid at that time that TJ went up there and took all the signage down that me and Reno had left up there, you know?
Uh-huh.
All the nice banners and stuff. And the building was just black.
Uh-huh.
And I went up there and had lunch with TJ one day. I was like, why are you taking all this shit down? He goes, well, Reno's going to sue me. I'm like, Reno ain't mad at you. Never has been. He said, well, Marcus. I said, well, that's Marcus. I said, Reno spent several $1,000s and a lot of time out there promoting Saul. As far as TJ is concerned, the only one that has any rights to that Saul name is you and him.
Right.
You know? And, you know, that's just Marcus, you know,
trying to start shit.
You know, or whatever, but, you know, TJ was, as far as Reno, was family, you know?
I think of it a lot like JP Jones and the Money Mark thing.
Yeah.
Marcus wanted to create this fake Monday Night War the community.
He tried to piggyback off of fucking Saul, because Reno and him, you know, Reno and him never probably did the numbers as far as money through the door, because there was a lot of comps on the Saul shows just to pack it out for fucking taping it.
Sure, yeah.
You know, but, you know, we put just as many people in there as anybody, and we the ones that kind of started that after the TNAs and all were gone. The first ones that really come in there and put over 700 or 800 people in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and then he was not far after that, piggybacking off of that. Mm-hmm. And I think, in my opinion, which don't mean shit, you know, in my opinion, the only reason Marcus had any success out there and kind of, because here's one thing, another thing I learned, if you're a promoter or wrestler, if you're running a show and you get hot, you can run off of that for a pretty good while if you keep it going.
Right.
You know, but eventually, you know, all the fucking hype on that show was what? The last show at the fair.
The last show.
Because the mayor was trying to sell the property to build condos or whatever. But all the news and media coverage on that. And he had the right, whoever come up with that main event, that was the right fucking match to have in there if that's going to be the last match of the fairgrounds.
Yeah.
Jerry Lawler, Bill Dundee.
Yeah.
Dutch Mantel.
Dutch Mantel is a ref.
Yep.
Yeah.
As far as the history of that fucking building, if I ran it tomorrow and was available, that's the two guys I would book. Mm-hmm. Regardless of how, you know, if you turn it into a schmoz and did a tag or something out of it. You know, that would be my advertised main event. Mm-hmm. But I think that's what got it that packed out for him. And then he just rode that wave on it. But I think his, what his downfall was, is he got so big that he wasn't budgeting the shows right. And who's the mark here? Booking all these guys, right? That's great. But if, at the end of the day, if he's not making any money, he's doing all that shit for nothing.
Yeah.
You know? But I never was around him then and didn't care to be, didn't want to be. You know, but I didn't like how he tried to manipulate TJ. That, and they even did something and gave TJ, like...
it was on the first show. They yeah. came, they gave TJ an award, I believe. Yeah.
But all that shit...
But by the second show, there was already the falling out had already...
Yeah, well, after that
first show... I think TJ was at the second show.
After that first show, Reno took him to fucking lunch and said, look, here, I hold the trademarks on all this. You need to cease and desist. Yeah. I'm using that name.
Yeah, I think TJ was at the
after,
second show.
That was after he come out with the advertisement for the second show. He done printed posters and everything on
that. Yeah, yeah. And then,
but
and
Reno
then TJ
did, Reno did that because, show. You know, I wouldn't want you... You know, if you started wrestling, mm-hmm. I wouldn't want you using my name.
Right, right.
You know, because that's, you know, not least
especially
without,
when you're not
at least without consent.
Right, you know? And you're not even, and you're specifically not saying, I'm not Kroll the Death Stalker. Yeah. Instead, he's not saying, we're working with Southern All-Star Wrestling. No, he's saying we are Southern All-Star Wrestling.
Well, either way, it don't matter, you know. I mean, shit, the logos I owned, the trademarks, don't, and here's another thing. Reno went out and trademarked them. As soon as that show.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and here's another. If you're a wrestler on a state level, like in Tennessee, you can go spend $25 and file a trademark on whatever you're calling or whatever. And that protects you for 5 years on a state level. And if you want to spend about $400 or $500, do it on a federal level, then, you know, that's up to you, you know.
But so Crossfire. 2013, Crossfire is dead. And around the same time, I believe, Reno is coming back to Millersville?
No, here's how that happened. All right, so when the whole, so August of 2012 was about probably the time Marcus was doing his second show. Mm-hmm. All right. So,
he did a show in August of 2012.
So the biggest thing that cracked me up was hearing people that I know and respect and love, like family in this business, are going around believe in this motherfucker. We got contracts. Well, it's not worth, you know.
No, I'm the same one.
All that fucking shit. All that bullshit. I'm like, dude, y'all are fucking delusional, you know. But you got to believe it.
Because I was ready to quit my job, you know. I was ready. I was working for Red Bull at the time.
But I mean,
just like the minute.
By the time August, by November, we were back up and fucking running. Mm-hmm. By that time, Paul, remember they had the gym that was just about 2 miles from
Old Hickory.
In Gulletsville, the gym that's not there.
Yes, yes.
It was the gym that where they did all the fab vignettes and stuff, and where Dundee got punched by Rick or sucker punched.
And Reno was going to build it out.
Well, no, they had a whole back part of it. It was like empty, like a warehouse. Well, that place leaked every 5 feet in there. Uh-huh. But they had Reno's ring set up that Crimson
owned. Uh-huh.
They had his ring in there set up for training, but it wasn't put together. And all the lights, all the banners, all the cameras, everything was in one pile out there. Because Reno had wanted me to go out there and get it. Because I had Tony's stadium in ring stored at my house and his ring trailer. And Reno wanted me and TJ to go out there and get his ring out of there because they were shutting the gym down. They sold the property, so they were shutting it down. So nothing ever happened out there.
Uh-huh.
It just became a storage place, and I went out there to get it, and I called Reno. I said, Reno, you need to get out here right now and look at this shit. All right, so Reno comes out there, and he's mad. He's like, all of our banners and stuff, it should be rolled up and stuff. It was just in a pile on the floor getting soaking wet from rain from this building. So, you know, that's probably $3,000 or $4,000 worth of signage and equipment and lights and shit just sitting there getting wet. And I told Reno, I said, man, you know, so that's why Reno gave me the CW spot, was because, you know, Paul was at his wit's end, you know, whatever the fuck he had going on in his life.
Uh-huh.
It just, again, timing, you know, that fell into my lap about 3 months after I was out there. So I had the CW spot for the last 2 or 3 years we were on,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then just like the NWA fell in my lap, Cersei, you know, Bruce Thorpe would come in and got control of that, and Cersei's like, you know, man, it'd be nice if you guys would, you know. So I did that out of respect for Cersei. Plus, plus I was excited to do it. So that's where it became NWA Salt.
Right.
You know.
So let's talk about that. Let's go into that. Wasn't it AWA Top Rope, though?
No, it never was.
It was always NWA Top Rope?
Yeah, that's the old, that was a version of the old Crockett logo that looked like
okay,
AWA.
Okay. So Cersei was running NWA Top Rope. You had TJ running, still running Showtime, or I'm sorry, Southern All-Star Wrestling. Yeah. And at the same time, a big change in the NWA took place where Thorpe took control.
Yeah.
Of the NWA.
Their lawsuit.
Started changing a lot of things, making sure people were looked presentable as referees, well, and, you know.
That was a lot of that was Cersei.
Was Cersei?
Cersei was the one that had, like, basically, like, if you were a promoter, he was the one you talked to about ordering your referee shirt and stuff. Bruce is a good guy, and if he had it now, I'd still be there. But to me, what Bruce brought to the table is he looked presentable. Whether he's,
as a president.
You know, people want to call him a mark with his jackets and stuff on when he's being a heel manager type. But, I mean, as far as wearing a suit, you know, he's a lawyer.
Right.
He fits the part of looking like an owner of a sports team or a wrestling company or something. So, you know, he would fly into your show, you know, and, you know, it's not Vernon that works down at the,
at the
corner store.
The president of the NWA is at your show.
Yeah, and he looks presentable.
With Jax Dane, with Tokyo. Yeah.
You know, but then again, that was kind of like to me, that was kind of like when we were running USWO in Madison and TNA first started. We were getting a lot of that talent that wanted to work. I mean, a lot of those guys, like Damian Wayne and Lance Erickson and stuff, those guys would drive 12 hours to come do our show.
Because you guys had the NWA TV. Yeah, you guys ran weekly television.
Yeah, us and Smoky Mountain.
And that was it, right?
Pretty much, that I know of, that had a decent, presentable product.
Right.
You know.
Right, so you were one of the stronger NWA affiliates.
For that year or two right there, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So let's kind of talk about that year, because you had Kojima. Wrestled two matches in one night, right?
Yeah,
I talked to Jeremiah Plunkett about that on my podcast. So let's talk to you about it. You know, tell me all about the whole Kojima thing.
Me and my buddy Ken, we're driving going to Rivergate to go eat, like, on a afternoon. And I get a call from Chris Ronquillo, that was at the time the vice president of the NWA under Bruce. He was pretty much the Paul Adams under Reno that ran everything as far as the
day to day.
And Bruce was, what I'm saying about Bruce earlier is that he's more like the guy that just wants to show up.
Right.
You know, but
he's the figurehead.
Yeah.
The face.
But at that time, that Chris Ronquillo guy, who didn't really know a lot about wrestling, because he numbered his shows. He ran Houston like every other month or once a month. And they was like NWA Houston 222 or. I don't know, but anyway, he called me. He's like, "Hey, Tim, we're bringing in the, you know," all this led up to going to Vegas for Rob Conway to win it back. They were bringing him in to do a spot on his show in Houston. But we had him the first night. We had him on Friday, then he was in Houston on Saturday, and then we were Sunday night in Vegas. He dropped the belt back to Rob, and that was the whole deal with that. And they called me wanting, you know, it's like, "Hey, you know, can you," I was like, "Yeah." I said, "Let me call Mike Cersei," because, you know, the money that we paid Kojima, was no way we could make it. At least I thought, because I knew who Kojima was, but I never, you know. I
didn't expect other people in the area.
So I called Mike Cersei. I said, "Hey, for X amount of dollars, we can get Kojima." He says, "Really?" I said, "But my thing is, if we bring him in and it flops, you know, I can't expect TJ to pay that."
Right.
He goes, "You got it."
Right.
So between me and Mike, we were going to make sure Kojima got paid. Mm-hmm. Well, we did a $10, you know, general admission like we always did. We did a $20 meet and greet with the $10 ticket and all that, with the color program and all that stuff. So we had actually pre-sold like almost 80 or 90 of those.
Of the $20?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So that more than paid for Kojima.
Uh-huh.
Cersei grilled out ribeyes for all the boys.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's out there.
I remember that day.
He's out there in a suit and tie, sweating like a fucking whore in church and doing fucking ribeyes. But I think out of the three nights that Kojima did,
uh-huh.
that we were the home run for him.
Right, right.
But
So
I called Chris Ronquillo back. I'm like, yeah, we'll do it. He goes, he says, New Japan is real tricky about who he wrestles. Who would you put him in the ring with? I said, well, at the time, my Southern champ was Jason Kincaid.
Uh-huh.
I said, either Jason Kincaid, my TV champ is Jeremiah Plunkett. But I said, you know, more than likely it's going to be Jeremiah Plunkett because he's our baby face that's there every week. You know, Jason Kincaid.
Get a little rub off him.
Jason Kincaid's only there, you know, when he's available.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, and that's what I told Ronquillo. So I guess he had just heard Jason Kincaid.
Uh-huh.
So basically we get, you know, this is like months in advance. This is like at least three or four months in advance because we did all those vignettes with Tracy Smothers and all.
Right. Yeah.
You know, which I think for what it was a good build up for the NWA title.
Yeah.
You know, and so anyway, we get down to putting out posters and stuff. You know, here's where everything is wishy-washy with Bruce and James Beard and Chris Ronquillo. You know, they don't have the balls to just call you up and tell you,
hey, I don't want you guys to do this.
You know, hey, we don't want Plunkett, you know, because nobody knows him, you know, as far as New Japan. So I get a call from Bruce just sporadically, and we talked for over an hour about everything, just, you know, and not one time did he come out and say, hey, they have issues with this, that, and the other. So I'm like, you know, I'm thinking, man, you know, because me and Bruce hit it off from the first time we talked, you know, as far as just talking wrestling.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, got along.
So we have a good conversation, you know, and he's talking about Japan, how he went and did this. So about an hour later, I get a call from James Beard. And this is on Mother's Day, like on a Sunday. And James
Beard. Everyone's calling you all
James,
of a sudden.
James Beard calls me, and I never had a lot of interaction with James Beard. James Beard's a good dude.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so he's, you know, instead of just coming out and telling me, it's like, hey, Timmy, this is not going to work with Plunkett, we would have went with Kincaid or whoever, you know, at that time. But, you know, so now I'm talking to James Beard. And he goes, Tim, we got a problem. No, it wasn't Mother's Day. This was like the Friday or Saturday there. This was in the afternoon after I talked to Bruce that day. And James calls me to let me down easy that they don't want Plunkett. That they're wanting, you know, so they're putting all the heat on New Japan. And I said, James, that's bullshit. I said, because, you know, yeah, we're getting them at a good price, this, that, and the other. I said, but the NWA champion, the whole purpose for bringing them in is to give a fucking rub to the fucking local promotion, you know, to make that guy more credible. I said, come on. He says, yeah, I get it. But, you know, I'm like, you know, so it just fucking pissed me off. He goes, well, you know, so never really told him that we would take Plunkett out of it. I just told him, I'm like, look, dude, you know, I already got fucking posters designed, you know, this, that, and the other.
You're selling tickets.
And we got fucking.
Because of Plunkett.
We got, you know, we had the Rudy Kalis with Plunkett and all that going on. And
who was that? The local news guy.
So then at time, you know, so then Mike Searcy come in. He goes, because, you know, they're trying to get to Mike, tell him, like, you know, we got to have, you know, but it's my fucking deal.
Right.
So Mike comes up with the idea. He goes, well, we're going to have a conference call tomorrow. Because Mike had this thing at the time where you could do, like, a party line.
Uh-huh.
So it's Sunday afternoon. It's Mother's Day. It's James Beard, Chris Ronquillo, Bruce Thorpe, me, and Mike Searcy on this fucking party line. And, so after about 2 days of this bullshit, I'm just like pissed off, you know. So we're on this conference call about 3 minutes in. And I'm like, look, I said, if y'all originally wanted his hand-picked opponent, y'all should have told us. You know, like, hey, we can get you Kojima, but we would need it to be. And everything would have been fine. The thing that pissed me off is just the wishy-washy, scared to fucking just stand your ground and tell somebody something. You know, so. After about 3 minutes in the call, I said, look, you motherfuckers. And I felt bad for doing it, but I just...
You just had it.
I'm like, look, you motherfuckers. I'm like, look, this can, you know, y'all can either get mad and pull the whole fucking thing, or y'all can bring Kojima in, and y'all can pay the motherfucker, and y'all can bring in whoever y'all want him to work. I will film it, edit it any way you want, give it to you on any platform you need to do whatever you need to do. You know, that's the only thing I see, you know, and Bruce is like, well, I gotta go.
Yeah.
So, So then that's how it became Damian Wayne. They were cool with Plunkett, but they wanted to have Damian Wayne. That way they could tell New Japan, hey, we got Damian Wayne, you know, because Damian Wayne and Lance Erickson had a big falling out because for months they were supposed to go to New Japan, but Lance Erickson couldn't get his passport for whatever reason on his stuff. So, you know, they knew of Damian Wayne as far as the NWA.
Right.
At least that was the bill of goods we were given.
Right.
So, you know, that was the whole reason to have, and it didn't really do Damian Wayne any good because he went out there and did like a 4-minute job for him.
Right.
You know, which he was fine, you know.
He was happy to do it, but yeah, that's not really the point.
You know, but then he felt bad too about it taking away from Plunkett's thing. So the way we did it, we shot a vignette in the back with Damian cornering Bruce and Chris Ronquillo, like, hey, you know, Kojima come up, like, that's how we had the match.
Right.
But, you know, that was the reason we put Plunkett on, like, third or fourth. I think he was on third.
Uh-huh.
And the whole reason we did that was because we drew so damn good that TJ had the fire marshal in there, like, three times. Uh-huh. Shut us down.
So you had to get the match out. You had to do it.
And I told TJ, I said, well, they can shut the somebody's down, but we're having Plunkett's have after all this bullshit we went through with them, Plunkett's going to have his goddamn match.
Right.
You know. So, you know, and you talk about happy to do something for one of the guys. Because I've known Plunkett since he started. You know?
Right.
And you talk about being happy to fucking do something and see somebody. The only thing I didn't like after it, Plunkett, you know, I thought he could have done a lot better as far as getting out more. You know,
right.
Kind of like, kind of like Kerry and Iggy do. But, you know, that's his call, you know. But, but I think he could have elevated his, you know, stock,
value with that,
you know. But you talk about far as a good match, Kojima was like, I watch you on YouTube, you know, on the plane. So he was familiar. He said, you do the gourd buster. You know, you do that, boom. I think of the three matches he had, because he worked at Houston Carson, he worked Plunkett Damian, he worked Rob Conway. I think that was his best match. And the because that fucking little building was fucking slammed.
You guys open up the...
Well, we had to because the codes was getting on us so bad with Chris Garrett pulling his stupid shit and calling the codes on TJ.
big man in charge. Yeah.
But, you know, they were coming up there making us open it up as an emergency exit. But TJ, like the fire marshal, he seen a lot of cars up there early, so they come, you know, that draws attention. So he come up there when we were doing the meet and greet with about 100 people in there. So then he said, well, I'm coming back. Well, he come back right as bell time. And, you know, we had done, I think we actually even started early because it was packed, you know. But we still had people coming. We turned away probably 50, 60 people easily. But TJ, at that time, the fire marshal came in there and said, how many you got? He says, I think about 140, because his limit with wrestlers, staff, and everything was 175.
So he kept that number right.
So TJ had people coming in. He goes, I'm gonna sell you a ticket, but you need to walk around the building and come in the back. But that place would hold about 190 to 200 people sitting. The way we had it set up with those risers and those bleachers that we had added the last year or two we were there. So it had to be pushing 250, 300 people. Because it's wall to fucking wall in there.
It was like a clown car in that thing, man.
but you talking about, if I knew that we would have drew that kind and turned away people, I would have took it to the fairgrounds.
Yeah, right.
But
you didn't know. You didn't know what is Kojima going to bring.
Yeah. But, with, you know, 2 weeks later, I'm in Vegas A few days later, I'm in Vegas with Cersei, and a couple weeks after that, TJ's dead. You know, when we were in Vegas, he actually went to the hospital. And so, that's one, if I'm proud of anything and what I've done in my shitty career as far as indie wrestling, that fucking show right there, for TJ, for that to be his last living thing to do in that fucking building, that was my proudest moment, that I was glad to do that for him.
Right. You know, I worked with the Weatherbys and LBK, their bread route. I was working with when TJ died. I remember the day, the day after, the morning after
he died. Another funny TJ story to that, too, is that, you know, Min Cersei paid Kojima So TJ made some good fucking money. You know, he did $10 tickets. So if he had 200 people, that's $2,000.
Right, right.
And plus his concession.
Right.
You know.
Which he had to sell out his concessions that night.
But, you know, he's going to pay me back for what I had. Because I think with the cookout and posters and stuff, I had close to a couple hundred bucks into the show that I wasn't expecting to pay me for, but we had,
he did so well.
You know, after the show, everybody's hanging out and stuff, and he didn't want to come out for that wide.
Right, sure.
And he's in the concession, and everybody's kind of hovered around, you know, kind of like James up there. And he goes, what owe you, Timmy? And I'm like, so he's trying to kayfabe everybody there, and I'm trying to kayfabe him. He's like, can you come by the house tomorrow? I'm like, yeah, because, you know, Sunday morning we're going to Vegas. He goes, yeah. He goes, come by the house. So I went by his house, and I'm glad I did because that was the last time I seen him alive. Or, you know, before he's in the hospital, you know, was able to talk to him. And that was kind of fun, you know, because he was like, he's like, even there, he's like, because, you know, some of his family there, he goes, what do you want me to give you? I'm like, TJ, you ain't got to give me anything, but if you want to give me something, I'll be, you know, because I thought he did good.
Right.
So he gave me, like, you know, my 200 bucks I had with the posters and the cookout stuff. And, but that was the last time I seen him alive. And for that, I mean, if I was going to be dead in 2 weeks after a show and had that big of a buildup and stuff, that would be one I'd want to go to.
So kind of talk about what happened with Millersville and how it all, because you kept on running after he died.
After he died, we did those two tribute shows to help raise money for his old lady and his kids. And after we did that, you know, basically everything in that building other than this concession stuff and some of the chairs, most of that stuff was mine, Reno's, and Mike Searson's.
Right.
You know, the ring was Mike, the barriers, the pads, all that was Mike. You know, TJ had an old ring that he bought from Mikey Dunn. It was a piece of shit that a lot of that wood got to use for the risers and stuff. And we redid everything in 08. So basically all he had in there was his concession stuff, the stuff in the lobby and some of the, you know, stuff in the building. But the lights and all that stuff was stuff we had.
Right.
So, you know, basically, we went to the landlord with this old lady, and they wanted to keep it going, you know, and it wasn't about trying to make money, but it was just trying to keep, you know, keep it alive for them.
Right.
So we went and talked to his landlord, and he was behind about 3 months on his rent. So basically, I had to agree to help pay that. So the only thing that kept Millersville alive those 10 or 11 months is because for I don't even know how many weeks it was, but for 3 or 4 weeks there, the guys worked for nothing to build up a little nest egg to help pay for
the behind stuff.
You know, because at that time, my wife wasn't working, and, you know, my money, my funds as far as doing extracurricular stuff, you know, was depleted. So, you know, the talent worked for about 3 or 4 weeks there, and which after we did those two tribute shows or benefit shows or whatever, you know, a lot of people quit coming. Nobody, you know, because it was like, that was it.
Right.
So it was like starting over from nothing, you know. We were drawing 20, 30, 40 people at best. You know, so you talking about, you know, struggling, you know, which the 3 or 4 shows they did there built up a little nest egg for me, but I'm sitting there paying off of 2 or 3 months back rent. Right. So after about 9, 11 months, you know, it again turns into the thing with Tony where I'm doing everything. You know, it's not just show up, cut the lights on, run wrestling. It's, you know, it's me paying the rent, paying the light bill. You know, I had to go get a business license. That's another thing I learned about. You know, TJ just squeezed by and never, you know, he would get one and let it, you know, all that stuff. But I actually had to go get a license with the city and the county. And the you love local government. When I went to Gallatin to get a business license for the county of Sumner County, they said, are you sure you're in the right county? You know, because Millersville's kind of on that. So I had to do that, and actually had to start filing. That was the only thing that saved me, is because I filed and had that loss to claim that kind of paid me back about half of what I did lose over it. But I was, me personally, I was losing about 100, 150 bucks a week up there for like 6-7 months after the funds depleted,
right,
that we had kind of built up with them working for free and everything kind of going in the nest egg. So after 2 or 3 months of that, you know, those last 6 months, I'm sitting there looting them.
Right.
And I'd let his family take over the concessions, and, you know, that just...
That hurts even more.
Between the biggest nail in the coffin was the landlord never would fix the roof. Mm-hmm. And I feel like TJ was behind on his rent that he never wanted to complain. It just kind of worked.
Right.
And at the time when the roof leaked, it leaked in the locker room and in the back of the building. But it got so bad that we had that ice storm or whatever. So between February and March, we only ran like 3 shows.
Right.
And here I am paying the rent,
2 months
and the utilities,
rent. Yeah.
And I don't have any money coming in.
Right.
And the people that ran the tire shop next door, they had got mad at the landlord and they cut the water off. So I'm sitting there, doesn't have any water, so I can't run a building where I don't have water with one bathroom. And getting back to the Chris Garrett thing, where he got into it with TJ's old lady and started calling codes on us and stuff. And the codes man coming there was making us keep the back door open 80 inches. So that by doing that, there's no way to heat or cool the building anymore. Not that we ever were real successful with that. But, you know, especially in the winter, there's no way to heat or cool the damn thing.
Uh-huh.
And the roof got so bad those 2 months there that it actually leaked in the damn room. And then, like, the front rowers, you know, were out there putting buckets and stuff up. And I'm like, man. After 9-10 months of that, dude, I was just toast. Mm-hmm. And I just got so mad, you know, it was like, here I am doing everything to try to keep this thing going, and I'm not making any money. I'm
putting
all my free time in it and actually putting money in it. And, you know, it just got to where it was like, you know, everything's got to end eventually.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But, you know, we carried him on to that 8th anniversary show, and after that, it just, you know, you kind of knew we were done. It was just like...
Was that Wolfie?
No, the 8th was Eric Andrews and Rob Conway for the world title. 2 years prior to that, it was Wolfie and Hayden for the world title.
So, with Millersville closing down, what was the next steps for?
For me?
Yeah.
I actually thinking I was done, because, you know.
Again. Right?
But about that time, a month or two later, for whatever reason, for Aaron Fox, he wanted to start running up in Kentucky. So him and Richard Lowe, you know, Farron wanted to get on TV down here on the Comcast thing, and my heart never was in it, but you know, Farron was running the boys club like once a month up there, then he'd run a couple other little spot shows, but then he found, you know, the building up there that James is running now, you know, and then, you know, I went up there with all my lights and curtains and stuff, which it worked for me because it gave me a place to store, and I'm like paying on the storage unit or something.
Right, right.
You know, but Farron, we went up there and did all that work, got that building looking like it was, and a few months later, it was like, wanting out, so he sold it to James, and then, I mean, I don't know what James seen in me, but we just, that first year or so he ran it, he just, like, he wanted me, kind of like Teeth, I don't know. I only knew James probably about 6 months before that. And we just kind of hit it off, I guess, because he seen, you know, my passion and how I was trying to get everything there and stuff. But, you know, I ran for James for probably a little over a year there before I took off and had all my personal family problem stuff going on. But that brings us about to where we are now, which... be sitting here on the couch talking about stuff.
So you think this is the last one? Is this the last?
Of me?
Yeah.
I don't know. Don't know, don't really care. Yeah,
seems like, you know, like it's an addiction that you can't really, you know, get rid of it. You know, like, I don't watch wrestling. I don't watch it on TV, like, but I can't stop thinking about it.
I talk to James all the time, almost every other day at least.
Uh-huh.
You know, main reason I don't want to go up there and do anything now is because, you know, he's grown as a person from what he was, because he was still pretty green at that time, but he's evolved into a promoter. And, you know, you can tell he had some, and I don't want to step on no toes. And, you know, he's got it going on, and he's doing fine by himself. But, I mean, if he knows I'm here if he needed something or something. But I mean, as far as that, if it's not helping James or Cersei, I really don't give a rat's ass about doing some. You know, I'd like to have the time to actually go through all my footage. I've got like 26 years worth of stuff, and I the first 200 something Saw episodes I actually got digitized now, where I actually can do something with them. So, out of about 7 year run of TV with Saw, I actually still got about 90% of that. And then the same thing with USWO, I got about probably 100% of that stuff.
And there's some real hidden gems in that. I mean, absolutely. You know, real, real hidden stuff.
Absolutely.
That a lot of people probably don't even know about. Let me do a couple of, I'm gonna throw some names out, and you just give me the first thing that pops in your head when you hear the name. The first one is Burt Prentice.
Survivor.
Sherry Martel.
Fucking awesome.
Yeah, how well did you get to know Sherry Martel? Because she was someone that never spent a lot of time.
Never met her.
You never got to meet her?
Never met her. But would have loved to.
Eric the Dragon Andrews.
One word. Probably, shit, I don't know. Eric, man, I was just around him so much. Probably like a son almost, as far as nurturing him as a talent. You know, I mean, I did so much with Eric. I mean, that's... You know, I got him a world junior title, got him a national title. There's a couple more things I'm proud of.
Do you think that maybe he missed his opportunity?
I mean, he never had a bad look, but if he had, like, just gotten, you know, definition to him, you know, lean, I think he would have had a better appeal.
It seems like every time that I show someone stuff from him, you know, they always are very impressed.
Yeah.
But it seems like he would be in the business, would be out of the business, would be in the business.
It's like kind of like Jim Cornette says, you know, you're either you get in this because you're crazy, or you get in it and you become crazy.
Right, right.
You know, it's kind of like with Eric. It's like he's either in or he's out. He's kind of like that guy that comes around for 2 or 3 years and then he's gone for a year and then he comes back. You know, but I mean, when you got him at 100%, you know, Eric was a good draw for us. When he was still real green in Madison, you know, and then he kind of, you know, we used him as tag teams, and then by about 06, 07, he was pretty much the top single guy, you know, and everybody else around here pretty much used him, you know.
Yeah.
Like we pretty much groomed him, so if I had one word to say about Eric, probably like mentoring his son.
What about LT Falk?
Like his dad, man, just lazy. I mean, to be honest, I love Tony, like a fucking brother, man. Probably more than anybody in wrestling. But I told Tony one time, I said, your son's actually lazier than you, Tony. He goes, I'll take that as a compliment. But I think LT's got unlimited potential, man. It's like, you know, it's like just wasted talent, you know. But I mean, you know, it is what it is, you know. Like the ones that have potential just kind of squint, you know.
Yeah, I mean.
You know, not that, you know, he's had a bad run, but I mean.
Could be more.
I'm the son of Tony Falk, you know, 20 years later. I'm the son of Tony, you know, I mean, you're still in the same area, you know. I mean, he's just trying to survive. I mean, he's not, I would say he's like the rest of us, you know, a closet mark for everything. But, you know, I mean, he's doing it to try to feed his family, you know, but. How many people you know working 2-3 times a week at best and making enough to survive?
Right. Yeah. What would you if someone were to ask you what your opinion, what you believe the legacy of the Nashville Fairgrounds in a pro wrestling context would be? What would you think that would be? What would you respond to?
Definitely the time the Jarrett's ran it.
Yeah.
I would say that. I think it's just been kind of hit or miss ever since then.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you figure that's been over 22 years.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think about all the, you know, the crossfires, the Freedom Pros, the overdrives? They all come in.
I think it's just how the business has evolved. It's not about running a weekly town or a month. You know, now it's kind of like, you know, how many high-level indies you got that kind of run the same little towns, you know? I mean, you know, that's kind of what Nashville's turned into. You know, Nashville's changed demographically from the last 10, 15 years. You know, I mean... Look, you know, you can't get around the city nowhere. You can't go 10 minutes down the road without taking you 20, 30 minutes and, you know, traffic. I mean, you know, it's a whole different, you know, it's like a whole different world, you know. Kind of miss the old days.
In the industry, especially here in Nashville, I think we all kind of know each other.
Yeah.
It's a pretty tight circle. What do you think, Kroll, the Death Stalker, Tim Thomason, who are you, and what will be remembered about you?
Ain't nobody gonna remember me. I mean, just a happy-go-lucky guy that, you know, grateful for what little bit I got to do in it. You know, as a person, I'm happily married and grateful to have a home and a job. And I'm 46 years old now, so my better years are probably behind me. But I'm grateful and happy for what I've been able to do. No regrets really, far as that.
And you are going through your footage, right?
Yeah, trying to.
And when we sat down, you said that you did start a PivotShare account. Who knows how far into that you'll be by the time people see this?
I'd see.
But is there an address that people can go to?
I've had a YouTube channel for about 11, 12 years now. I've got a good bit of what I've done as far as like the whole NWA run. All of our TVs are on there. A lot of the Saul, USWA, Mike Cersei, NWA Top Rope stuff's on there. So I've probably got 300-400 videos on there, just different stuff. It's some pretty good. There's not a lot of crap on there.
What's the?
It's basically my original, it's AWA, no, it's American Wrestling Alliance TV is what my handle on YouTube is, but you can just go to youtube.com/ Krizzle is my physical address originally of it.
And the last question that I want to ask you, and I want you to be as bluntly honest as you can, Dale Gagne has...
Dale Gagne. Yeah.
Has multiple times, this reaches as far back as when Chase was using the AWA name for Arcadian, then the AWA name for New South. He's made it be known that he owns AWA. Explain in full terms exactly what... he does not own.
Well, as far as what he owns or don't own, you'd have to ask him. But as far as the AWA, from what I do know is that Vince McMahon owns whatever Vern Gagne owns, which would be the logo, the trademark, and the footage.
Only the footage that he purchased, because ESPN also owns AWA footage as well.
But as far as like who actually owns a name, what James is doing is, it's just American Wrestling Alliance, and I'm sure there's been probably 10 American Wrestling Alliance. Vern Gagne was American Wrestling Association on their tag belts. It says American Wrestling Alliance. But if you do a U.S. trademark search on AWA Wrestling, it doesn't show that he owns it that I know of. But a trademark's only good for 5 years, and nobody can do an initial search or whatever, but I don't think what James is using it with is infringing on anything that anybody owns. It's a completely different logo. The thing with Dale Gagne that I do know is when he was running it, he was trying to say that he was what Vern was.
Right.
Using
right.
the same logo, the same title history, the same titles, all that. What James is doing is just using the initials.
Right.
I'm sure there's 10, 20 other indies around the fucking world using it. I don't know, don't really care. We were just trying to keep with that NWA theme of trying to work with people and stuff,
Do you think Dale is full of shit?
I've never met the guy, so I
can't. Why is this a part of us?
He is, he was sued by Vince McMahon, James is, James ain't even calling it AWA, his is AWA New South Championship Wrestling. I'm sure if Vince McMahon was worried about, Vince McMahon owns what Vern owns, so if anybody had any right to say, hey, you can't call yourself this or that, I would say it'd be Vince McMahon. But what I know, and $5 will buy you a fucking happy meal. But as far as Dale Gagne, he was sued with the, but even if he did, I don't see how what James is doing is affecting him or anybody else, because it's AWA New South Championship Wrestling. I'm sure Dale Gagne wasn't AWA New South Championship rep.
Yeah, I don't think so.
No, but if it is, you know, if it's such a big deal, tell them to send him a cease and desist. I like that.
You said he did last time. He said he was planning to start one now.
So we'll leave it there. Thank you very much, Kroll, for taking this time with everyone at WrestleTopia. And we appreciate the opportunity to sit down and talk to you about the 90s and beyond.
All right. Well, that was the interview right there.
I thought it went really well.